Coming up today, SpaceX success, Fatberg facts, why the government's got it wrong about the gig economy, and we go inside Britain's Facebook-loving alternative alt-right. You're listening to episode 355 of the WideUK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matts Burgess.
Hello.
And Reynolds.
Hello.
Facts, Matts Burgess.
I'm going first. The first guide horse to be used in Britain has started its training this week. The horse is named Digby. It's an American miniature horse and it lives up to the age of, well, the breed in general lives up to the age of 45.
Right. Why is there... So this is a... What? Why is there a guide horse?
So they're actually used a little bit in the US already. So a few people have them over there. I think this one's being trained because the person who is using it here is allergic to dogs.
Okay.
So makes sense, really.
This is a guide horse for the blind and visually impaired.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Huh.
How big is it?
Knee height? So maybe a little
bit
higher.
It's like a big dog size.
Yeah, it's not massively bigger than a dog, but Digby is like doing a good job. Well, hopefully.
Well, great. I have nothing to add. Matt Reynolds?
So, since it was released, you remember the Killer song, Mr. Brightside, right?
Yeah, I know where this is going.
Yes.
I don't remember it, actually. Can you help me out?
That's not the one where he says he doesn't look a thing like Jesus. Is that one?
No. Ooh.
You know what? This was played at school discos so much because like, it was in 2004, which is when I was like at secondary school.
I'm not going to pretend to remember the Killers. I have no idea. No, yeah, I remember Mr. Brightside.
It was such an anthem.
It's an earworm, an absolute earworm.
Such an earworm that it hasn't been out of the UK charts since then, since its release in 2004. But it's been back in the top 100 every single year, so it's kind of reappeared.
Good Lord.
Who doesn't own it?
Me.
Yeah, but
I don't own it. I lie. If it was on the Hot Fuzz album, I did own it.
Moving on.
Downloading it every... Well, enough people downloading it every year to be in the top 100.
Maybe you lose it?
Yeah, possibly.
I don't know. Anyway, yeah. I learned that Glyptodon, a large armoured mammal that lived in South America about 2 million years ago, looked a bit like an anteater, but unlike an anteater, it was the size and weight of a Volkswagen Beetle.
You couldn't have a guide Glyptodon then?
I guess you could.
It'd be difficult if your guide animal was the size of a car.
There were a lot of animals back then, say back then, you know, sort of in prehistoric times.
Back in the day,
in prehistoric times, who looked like big versions of what we have now. So like a woolly mammoth was a giant, giant, giant elephant. And the elephant descendants of it are smaller mammoths in a way. So I guess anteaters got smaller. There were big sloths as well, weren't there?
Anteaters got smaller, people got bigger.
Yeah.
Wait, there weren't tiny, tiny people back then.
No, people, the ancestors of modern-day Homo sapiens were smaller.
Yeah, but I think that I'm imagining like a kind of like, a kind of like 5-inch human, like, you know, equivalent anteater size, where I think that, actually, I'm going to stick with that myth. People were tiny.
They were. And a true fact, horses used to be the size of cats.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so there's horse skeletons, horse fossils that have been found from the early evolution of horses. They started around the size of cats.
I've always thought that like dogs are the equivalent of horses that live in people's houses.
Okay, great.
Well,
good
that's
to
true,
know.
Digby, right? Proves it.
There we go. Yeah.
Okay, first story this week. It's remarkable. If you haven't seen it, go and find a video of it. SpaceX's Falcon Heavy launch. Perhaps Elon Musk's greatest success to date. We were all ridiculously impressed by it. Matt, catch us all up on exactly what happened.
So if you didn't see it, this was the first launch of the Falcon Heavy rocket. It is the biggest, most powerful rocket in the world at the moment. There's been bigger rockets previously, like the Saturn V, which was used on the Apollo missions back in the 1940s. But this is the biggest one that sort of is around now. It is effectively three Falcon 9s, which is the rocket that SpaceX has been using for like the last 4 or 5 years probably now.
Yep.
Three of them strapped together. There are 27 engines, and it took it launched for the first time from Cape Canaveral, and it basically was just a proof of concept that it worked. Elon Musk, before the rocket lifted off, said there was a 50-50 chance of it blowing up and being absolutely useless in a massive PR stunt for SpaceX. It took a new Tesla Roadster into space.
I hate that so much.
It's really good.
It's the most annoying thing ever, but yeah,
cool, but a bit pointless, really.
Utterly pointless.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. But perhaps one of the greatest advertising stunts, marketing stunts of all time, to have a picture of your car with the sort of a mock-up mannequin of what you imagine a spacesuit might look like when you decide to colonize Mars as Elon Musk, sitting in it, driving it, flying past the Earth.
Being live streamed on YouTube.
Yeah.
I sat there watching it for about 20 minutes, just going round the Earth.
Yeah, the pointlessness is valid, but dear God, this was impressive.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And then as well as that car being sort of launched into space, and it's now somewhere heading towards the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, because it slightly overshot what it was supposed to be doing to get into the Mars orbit.
Whoops.
But you can't get everything perfect. And there were a couple of other things that weren't quite perfect about this mission. Two of the Falcon 9s, which were as part of the landing liftoff rockets to take it up there, yep, they came down and landed, which I think if anybody's, obviously the people who have seen this story are probably well aware of the video, the image of them both coming down, landing in sort of some
vertically
unison.
That is amazing, isn't it? To think that I'm not quite sure how high up they were when they kind of like ejected off the side, the kind of side boosters, but maybe there were, you know, dozens of kilometers in the air. To think that they came from that far in the air,
yep,
came down to Earth, and they were, you know, moving at huge speeds, hundreds of kilometers an hour, and they landed perfectly in unison. Like, yep, that, you know, was like unbelievable, just as much as the actual launch. It took
and
my breath away.
Those boosters have already been to space and back.
Oh, really?
They've been used before once already. And this is saving tens of thousands of dollars, tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, it really is. And just to go back up to the third one, which we didn't mention, that crashed and burned in the sea, basically.
Whoops.
It was supposed to land on a drone ship, but it didn't quite get there. You can't quite have everything perfect, I guess. Like, the launch just not exploding was probably a good enough start. Mm. But the bigger thing is, moving forward, this rocket is going to be used for the next few years, but it's not really SpaceX's priority.
Which is weird, seeing as they've just put in so much effort into making a big song and dance about it. But it was always the case that this was sort of an experiment, a proof of concept, so that now they're going on to look at this bigger rocket, which is called the Big Fucking Rocket, or BFR.
Yeah, they are. So this is going to be what Elon Musk wants to use to send people into space and to sort of colonize Mars. And the BFG...
BFG! Big Friendly Giant.
Yes, that's... Well, no. Big Fucking Rocket.
Oh, no, but that's BFR.
Oh.
Okay. Oh, dear.
That was just getting confused.
Oh, start again. We'll pretend we didn't hear.
Okay, the BFR,
yes,
is going to be the rocket that Elon Musk wants to take people to Mars to colonize, and it will be even more powerful and probably the most powerful rocket that has ever been created. So to give you a couple of stats around it and sort of how it compares to the Falcon Heavy and also the Falcon 9, the BFR will be able to take 150,000 kilograms into low Earth orbit. When compared to the Falcon Heavy, that can take around 63,000 kilograms into low Earth orbit, and the Falcon 9 can take 22,000 kilograms into low Earth orbit.
So the Falcon Heavy, double it. The Falcon 9, quintuple it.
Exactly. So it's going to be a lot bigger. But one of the other points that you've sort of touched upon already, James, is as sort of SpaceX can reuse these rockets, the space flight is actually getting cheaper as well.
Yeah.
So we're heading for sort of an age where it will be cheaper to send more things into low Earth and sort of geostationary orbit going around the
Earth.
The Earth. But what's the bit around the middle called? The equator.
Yes.
That's geostationary orbit, where it's going around there. I've lost my train of thought.
You've lost your train of thought, but basically what you're saying is it will be cheaper, and as the International Space Station comes towards its end of life in the next decade or so, it remains to be seen how long NASA and other space agencies are going to keep funding it and maintaining it. but there's going to be a real need to get big bits of construction into space for future Earth orbital stations, but also potentially for moon bases, either in orbit around the moon or on the moon, that will then become the launching pads for missions to Mars and deeper into the solar system. So it's always a bit like this with space stuff. There's some of it that's relevant now and will allow the commercialization of space and stuff to be cheaper, but we're looking at the future happening right now. It's just that it's step one, and step two is going to be this bigger, more powerful rocket, and then there'll be a greater commercialization of space, and before you know it, there'll be potentially a new space station up there, a base on the moon, a base around the moon, and people living on Mars.
Exactly. And while Musk is not sort of planning to develop the Heavy or the Falcon 9s much further, there'll probably be some sort of tweaks to them.
Yeah.
They will still be used for the next 2 years because the BFR is not going to be in sort of in testing until sort of early 2020, at like the very, very earliest, and then sort of hopefully taking people in the 2 or 3 years after that. So the Falcon Heavy will be used for a few more years, and each liftoff that SpaceX sort of charges customers for costs $90 million for a Heavy, mm-hmm. Which is 3 Falcon 9 strapped together, and one Falcon 9 launch costs $62 million US dollars, that is. So for 3 rockets, you are getting sort of, you're only paying half as much as one.
Mm.
And you can take a lot more stuff into space.
So it's sort of a buy one, get one free, or buy two, get one half price sort
that's
of deal.
It, yeah.
Yeah, he's been spending a bit too much time in
Walmart.
So
that's what's going to happen with the Heavy for the next few years.
Yeah.
And the Falcon 9s. There's a few military launches, I think, that are potentially planned for the Falcon Heavy.
Yeah.
And also a couple more satellites. But I'm sure after the impressiveness of this week, there'll be probably a few more people queuing up to use the Heavy.
Yes, their order book will be getting a bit busier. If you haven't seen any of the footage from this, and you really should have by now, head online, hunt it down. You want to see the video of the Roadster flying through space, which is, as you say, just a ridiculous publicity stunt, but kind of cool. But especially the rocket taking off, the heft of this thing, and then the two boosters perfectly touching down in unison. It's a remarkable sight. And the progress that SpaceX has made, much as there's a lot of skepticism and cynicism around it, Elon Musk might be a bit of a difficult personality, but the people that he's got working for him are tremendously talented engineers, and they're throwing an awful lot of private money at solving a problem that was previously reliant on public funding, which can only be a good thing because it frees up public money to do more important things while Elon Musk is funding this incredibly, incredibly expensive endeavor. So, yay. Second story. Bit of a departure. Britain first. It was November last year, I believe, when Donald Trump, the President of the United States, retweeted a post from a woman called Jaja Franson. You may not have ever heard of her, but she is the deputy leader of Britain First, a fringe, I think, fair to say, political organisation in the United Kingdom that is now no longer even a political organisation because it failed to pay its deposit to remain as one. That got us thinking. What is Britain First and how is it so successful online? So this is an organisation with more followers on Facebook than any political party in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, yeah. Add them together and more than them.
All added together.
So, yeah, it's got more Facebook likes on its own than the Tories, Lib Dems, Labour added together.
It's incredible. And that the success of that strategy, arguably, led to Donald Trump seeing a tweet from someone who is not just a fringe view, but someone who might be put to prison,
yeah.
Be sent to prison for her views and her actions. Anyway, I'm rambling a bit. Basically, Matt Reynolds, you spent the last few months going very, very deep inside what's going on behind this.
Yeah, exactly. I guess a good place to start is that, like you mentioned, kind of like the Donald Trump, and a lot of his rise has been attributed to like the success of the alt-right in America. And this is this kind of like this meme machine, right, that comes out of Reddit and it comes out of 4chan and places like that. And they see themselves as the kind of, I guess, Donald Trump's army of kind of pushing this very internet-centric kind of right-wing agenda. Well, you know, in the UK, we're a little bit behind, right? We're not as sophisticated as they are in the US. And so basically what I kind of dug around with is if you like, the alternative alt-right. And essentially what it boils down to is this kind of very small group of religious extremists that are based in Serbia and Hungary that basically target UK Facebook users, millions of them, with hundreds and hundreds of kind of... some of it's extreme content, some of it's kind of like distorted and plagiarized news, some of it's like adverts of weird crusader organization, but there's this huge kind of like bubbling far-right meme economy, if you like, that's going on. And it's got millions of people looking at it every day.
And this is through like a series of different Facebook pages and groups?
Yeah, exactly. So kind of like connecting all these groups, there's about a cluster of 13 Facebook pages and around 5 of these kind of weird plagiarized news sites. And basically, if you do much poking around, you basically find out that these sites are reposting and posting exactly the same story. So there'll be like a news site that is like, Virgin sells her virginity on eBay. You know, great shareable story that originated from the Daily Mail or the Sun, I think. That ends up being plagiarized by a site called News Chicken. And then that ends up on a series of Facebook groups called stuff like English and Proud and British Freedom and I Like to Wear My Poppy. And so you kind of get an idea of this kind of tone. And basically, this farming of content is really to draw people into these Facebook pages in particular that then go on to share this more extreme content that has this kind of like Christian fundamentalist agenda, and also this fundraising for these extreme far-right kind of fringe groups that have links with paramilitary border patrols. So, you know, it's not many steps from these kind of viral news stories before you get to these really nasty, quite clearly illegal extremists.
And it all comes back to the question, who's behind it and how are they able to be so successful? So to take Britain First, and Britain First sort of stands aside from this network of sites and pages that we looked into, but there is a clear link between them that comes down to one man and his seemingly successful strategy for getting Britain First to go viral.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one man is a guy called Jim Dowson, who, in terms of the UK far right, well, I mean, there's not many parts of the UK far right that he hasn't touched. He's a bit of a serial figure, right? So just give him a little bit. Let me give you Jim Dowson's CV, if you like. So he was originally a trained Calvinist minister. He was very strongly involved in a really nasty anti-abortion campaign that used to do stuff like send pictures of fetuses to nurses that worked in hospitals and things like that. He was then part of the kind of Ulster loyalist protests in Northern Ireland, including some kind of these big kind of like flag protests they had around the riots. At the same time, he then was a fundraiser for the BNP. He claimed he raised £4 million for the BNP back in 2011. And then he went on to help found Britain First in 2014. And that's really when we get to this, the beginning of his kind of social media skills. I think that you can see that strategy of, you know, extreme images and stuff that kind of gets people sharing and piques their kind of disgust and stuff like that was, you know, in as much earlier stuff he was doing. But really it was when he kind of launched Britain First and he managed to capitalize on stuff like the death of Linda Bellingham, the British actor, and stuff like, you know, animal abuse, that he basically cultivated this very populist series of memes and content that basically helped Britain First. You know, in its first year, it got something like 500,000 likes, which, you know, puts it above most of the major political parties in the UK. And then within the next couple of years, it had got up to 2 million. And this is totally down to this one guy. And it's that guy that was then involved in setting up this ring of 13 Facebook pages and associated distorted news sites, which also claim credit for helping to support Donald Trump. There's this site he set up called the Patriot News Agency, which basically churned out kind of anti-Clinton propaganda and all that stuff we kind of saw. And he'd been very kind of like vocal and public about this, saying that, you know, I helped elect Donald Trump. But now that focus has turned back to the UK pretty seriously.
And we put some of these concerns to Facebook that it was only a certain number of leaps away from some fairly nasty individuals doing some fairly abhorrent things, and in the case of Britain First, a chance that some of the more senior figures in the party currently may go to jail for their actions. And Facebook's response was, well, it doesn't breach our community guidelines. We've got an overview of what's happening, but there's nothing that we can do. And this is the trouble that Facebook keeps on hitting up against. There's no transparency around who is running these pages, what agenda they're running them for. And this works both for the left and the right wing of the political spectrum. You look at news sites like The Canary, for example. There's a huge amount of controversy around the kind of stuff that they peddle and how viral it goes on social media. So you can appeal to either end of the political spectrum. But what's particularly interesting here is the success of this one man in establishing this very, very little known network of sites. So all the sites are on the same server, all the pages have the same iconography, they're all linked to this organization called Knights Templar International. They're all trying to sell Crusader merchandise, but also they're all trying to get you to like funny memes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the thing, is that actually on the surface, if you look down these sites or these Facebook pages, you think like, it might not be the stuff that I would like, but it's certainly, like you said, James, it's not stuff that necessarily would violate kind of hate speech. But actually, if you kind of look a bit deeper and look at the overall narrative and also these other adverts they're pushing and things like that, it's a very strange kind of like a Christian fundamentalist kind of idea that is, it's all about preparing people for this kind of coming war between Islam and Europe. And the basic narrative is Europe is in decline, join this organization and get your Templar merchandise because we need to kind of like take up arms. And this
like
has been
capes.
Yeah, totally.
And spears.
Like, yeah, capes and mantles and all kinds of weird, you know, it's actually on the surface of it, quite similar to kind of KKK stuff, really. That's probably the closest resemblance it bears.
Yeah.
And really, it's not many leaps at all from that to these paramilitary groups that have been patrolling the kind of Turkish-Bulgarian border with guns and with night vision goggles in the forest, saying, like, we're looking to get stop migrants entering Europe. Yeah. Because Knights Templar International has directly said it is funding these groups, which have already been basically kind of dismissed by the kind of governments in Hungary. So, you know, they're not state-backed groups in that way.
And Dawson himself has been denied entry into Hungary, so he's effectively been booted out of the country for things that he did while there.
Exactly, for hanging around with these types of groups. And this is the thing. So I kind of put this to Facebook and I said, like, okay, so none of these posts taken individually necessarily violate these quite clear kind of like hate speech boundaries that they have, but I was saying, well, actually, what about a site that is kind of advertising fundraising for stuff that then gets to fund activities that are kind of illegal or are, you know, or definitely kind of like politically extreme.
Yeah.
And they, this is when kind of like Facebook said, well, this is a bit more of a grey area, right? They said, like, well, we can't really control what happens off the platform, and we also can't follow up every link and know where every funding is, because,
well, they can.
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. And I think that this kind of like speaks quite directly to where Facebook sees its responsibility lying. Because I think, you know, like you said, we've actually seen YouTube withdraw videos or withdraw certain advertisers from videos, right? Saying, actually, we won't allow ISIS to fundraise off these videos and that type of thing. And actually, whereas what Facebook is saying is kind of like disavowing its responsibility to provide a platform.
Yeah, but they're not selling them directly through Facebook, to be clear. It's an advert to take you to an external site where you probably use some sort of payment service to pay into their bank account. But this is a case of following the money, right? So you might have a front for an organization that is fundraising that then goes into buying camo suits and night vision goggles and weaponry for a paramilitary group that's patrolling a border to try and stop migrants from entering Europe. And it's just a case of following the money. This is what a legal investigation into this kind of thing would do. And what Facebook is saying is that it is not the end point, sort of the soft end of that money trail.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's, and moreover, I think what Facebook is saying, that actually the only things that we can really police is what people say on our platform. And you know, and when I spoke to people at Facebook about this, they were saying, look, we're pretty aware of these sites, and these definitely, they use the phrase kind of like toe the line of what's kind of acceptable. So these are definitely ones they're kind of watching out for.
Yeah.
But I think that actually it's about the question of, well, how far does that responsibility go? And I wonder if these tweaks that we've seen to the news feed that basically deprioritize news articles and stuff like that, so in effect making these pages less prevalent in people's news feeds, is really an attempt to say, actually, we don't have the will or effort to follow this money and to necessarily look at our kind of culpability all the way. So actually, one way to do is just, you know, lessen the kind of impact. So I wonder, obviously Mark Zuckerberg has not said that that's the reason why he's doing stuff like this, but it seems like one way to wash your hands of it is just to say, you know, let's just not.
It's the same issue with all types of fake news and sort of the propaganda that we've seen sort of coming from Russia and elsewhere, and any group that sort of has a interest. Like, if it's being seen by fewer people and Facebook is not prioritizing it as like something that lots of people are engaging with and showing it to as many people, then the responsibility for them lessens.
Yes, absolutely. And what's the reason that we pursue this story for so long and feel that it's different to everything else that's out there is the iconography of this is different. The people behind it are different. The kind of people it's targeting are different. And so this whole network is very, very separate from the pages that were set up around the EU referendum in the UK, are separate to the pages and websites that were set up around the presidential election in the United States. This is a whole new vertical, if you like, of gaming algorithms, gaming social networks, and gaming content, if you like, because an awful lot of this is reliant on taking stories from legitimate news organizations and placing them completely out of context to maximize outrage. And Facebook doesn't have an opinion on that.
No, exactly. Yeah, when I originally spoke to kind of someone from Facebook's public relations agency, I kind of like put this to them and said, like, this seems a very clear attempt to kind of get a very specific type of British person, like you alluded to, James. I mean, really the type of people we're talking about that like and share this content are, broadly speaking, older, probably in their mid-40s, British, white, tend to be male, but you know, both genders as well. And they also tend to be kind of like slightly less educated on the whole. It's mm-hmm. it's hard to kind of like typify an entire group, but this is more or less the audience they're kind of squarely aiming at. But you know, in terms of whether, you know, when I pose a question of whether Facebook should be, you know, enabling this or allowing this kind of like distinct targeting to kind of go on, but, you know, and the end aim is to try and influence the political conversation in the UK, really, to try and normalize these more extreme views. The response I got was that Facebook, you know, is a private company. Facebook doesn't have an opinion on, you know, the on how our views are being kind of altered. But you know, and it's, I think it's quite clear that from what we've seen about how Facebook has been used in the past, that Facebook might not have an opinion on it, but there are plenty of actors that are willing to exploit it for exactly that reason.
Yeah.
And if Facebook not having an opinion amounts to that's why we don't do anything about it, then I think that, well, that is an opinion, right? Because this is kind of being used in this way, and to kind of disavow your kind of responsibility, it seems to me like more like ignoring the question rather than making some kind of stand for freedom of speech.
Yeah, and it's these tactics taken in aggregate. So it's the number of pages, the number of likes, the reach, the engagement, the organization that's behind this pumping out hundreds and hundreds of stories a day, plagiarized onto news sites and moving those around servers as they're banned and blocked. Some pages Facebook has removed, I believe some of the ones that were set up around the US election by Dowson, seemingly by Dowson and his team. But they're just not really grappling with this issue because they can kind of get away with seeing it as something that's ill-defined, and it's not ISIS. It's not one thing. It's difficult to pin down. And so Facebook can kind of wash its hands of it and say, well, it's not in breach of our guidelines. But taken in aggregate, surely it would be.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I think that you also have to look at, well, why are these groups doing this? You know, if it's not having an input, why would they do it? So it's worth saying that, you know, these groups and Britain Versus including this have like no representation in local government or in national government. So that's not a route they can go through. They have very, very poor membership on the ground. Something like Britain Versus is lucky to muster a dozen protesters, let alone the army of millions that you might see online.
And this is super interesting. So Britain First has about 1,000 members in the real world. How many likes on Facebook?
1.9 million.
1.9 million. So more than all of the other political parties in the United Kingdom combined. It's no longer a political party because it didn't pay its deposit to remain being so. And for people who say that, oh, well, this is just a bit left-wing media hand-wringing, Britain First is directly connected to a man who drove a car into a group of people outside a mosque in London, taking one of their lives and I think injuring 9 others. And in the lead up to that attack, he was researching Britain First online. He was exchanging messages with the people who are senior in right-wing organisations in the United Kingdom. So there is a very, very direct correlation between an organisation that has no reach, no influence, no voice in the real world, but is able to reach 2 million people on Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is the point that I think that you see by this very concerted effort to build these kind of online followings in this very kind of like duplicitous and specific way, that what they're doing is saying, look, we're not going to achieve prevalence through kind of like more legitimate means or kind of representation. Yep. What we can do is influence the conversation that people are having in line, online. And I think we've seen that, you know, that's incredibly influential. Just look at the kind of policies that you see in Donald Trump, or the, you know, in the UK, the fact that Brexit happened, or you've got Jacob Rees-Mogg, you know, being anti-abortion in cases of rape. You know, these are conversations that were
fringe.
Yeah, fringe.
Extreme fringe.
Unthinkable in mainstream politics, but have been normalised on platforms like Facebook and also Reddit and things like that. And because of that normalisation, I think you can argue, they've actually been accepted into the mainstream. Because if you see a Twitter page and it's telling you every day that we're being invaded by Muslims and every day that we're, you know, whatever's happening, well, it makes sense that you'd have a policy like Brexit that comes into place to answer that.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think we have to really rethink, well, actually, you might not be a political organisation, but that doesn't mean you're not influencing the political conversation.
Yeah.
And that's why we should take these things seriously.
Yeah. And to move this on slightly, is there an ideal solution or an outcome to this sort of behaviour? And well, where does the responsibility lie, I guess?
If I may. So the British National Party, which was sort of the forerunner to Britain First until its complete collapse as an organisation, I think it was a couple of elections ago in the United Kingdom, the leader then of the British National Party, a guy called Nick Griffin, was invited onto Question Time, which is our prime time political debate watched by sometimes 10 million people, particularly around a big election. And they said, OK, we're going to invite the BNP on. And everyone was like, you can't invite on the BNP. This is giving them a platform. This is legitimizing their views. So they had a number of senior people from the various parties. And then they had Nick Griffin from the British National Party. And it was from that moment that that party catastrophically collapsed, because he was shown to be who he was. So that's the solution.
It's to
take these parties out, these movements out of their bubbles online, and to put them on a platform and just watch them completely collapse.
Yeah,
once you take them out of their bubble, then they're shown to be the utter clowns that they are.
Yeah, Nick Griffin, very good friends with Jim Dowson also. They're forever at far-right conferences in Hungary and in Russia and these kind of places.
So, yeah.
And I think actually these views might be mainstream, but the people involved with it are such a small group of fringe thinkers that are kind of shaping this kind of bigger conversation. I think that, like you said, really when you expose the people behind it and actually how thin the veneer of popular support really is, because let's be honest, liking a post or liking a page because it posts a meme saying, how do you like your steak cooked? Like, you know, comment and share if you like it well done or something, does not amount to an endorsement of those politics, but it is a route through which you can kind of start to normalize that. So I think that, you know, I think it's a bit, you can, like you said, by bringing them into the light, you can kind of start to really undo and understand that myth.
Yeah, so I always say this, but I would wholeheartedly recommend that people go and read this story. There's an awful lot of detail that we couldn't bring onto the podcast. It's really, really fascinating. You'll find it on the homepage, wired.co.uk. We're going to continue on a similarly serious theme. This week, a courier for a firm called DPD died. Well, he died in January. He was a 53-year-old man, and he had diabetes, and he'd worked for the courier company DPD, which is owned by the French government. It was founded in the 1970s. He worked for them for 19 years, and according to reports, he was too afraid to miss shifts that he had to work, fearing £150 fines and loss of earnings, etc., that he skipped medical appointments. And eventually he collapsed at the wheel of his van, and shortly after that he was hospitalised, where he died. I think he was in his 50s, and he leaves behind his wife and a 22-year-old son. Also this week, it's been a big week for the gig economy. Also this week, the government published its response to the Taylor Review into the changing nature of work in the modern technological economy. So two very, very important things happened this week that highlighted a number of problems with the gig economy.
They're both pretty well connected in some cases, as you're going to go on to explain. But for people not familiar with the Taylor Review, can you give us a brief summary of what that was and sort of what the government responded to it? Because it's been several months since the Taylor Review was first published.
Yeah, so this was an independent review commissioned by the government. Matthew Taylor, who used to be, I think, an advisor to the Blair government, carried it out. And the idea was to look at the changing nature of work and to take the premise that digital technology is rapidly changing how we work, how we're employed, and to make some recommendations based on that. Seemingly, the government told Matthew Taylor that the review should not propose new primary legislation, which it doesn't. So the government has taken on more or less every single point that it's made. It's even gone further on a couple of points. And broadly, the government's response is that digital technology is rapidly changing the nature of work and that we need to provide more benefits to people who are working in the so-called gig economy, but we also need to be better with employment law to make sure that they have the right kind of rights. And this comes back to the DPD courier. He was called Don Lane. So he was self-employed. Technically, that means that DPD was a customer of him. He was running his own courier company, even though he wasn't. So you start to get an idea of the strange machinations of how the gig economy works. And I'd say the mistake that the government's made in its response, and I'd be interested to get your thoughts on this, is that the gig economy is technological innovation. Whereas what we're seeing time and time again is that it's not. It's an old-fashioned form of exploitation against the most vulnerable workers in society.
Well, yeah, I think that, yeah, that's exactly the point. And I don't think there's anything really that innovative about the gig economy other than that you can sign up to jobs online and through an app. You know, it makes access to those jobs easier. But if you think back to 100, 150 years ago where there wasn't robust employment law and you could be dismissed at a moment's notice and you could be fined or fired for not coming in that day, you didn't have sick pay and stuff like that. I mean, isn't that kind of the gig economy, right? It's labor on demand, and none of the kind of benefits or responsibilities fall on the employer. And so another thing kind of like behind the gig economy is that it's kind of a response to lack of stable employment and that thing. So I think that to paint it as this picture of like, well, the world's kind of like growing faster and we're catching up, actually in ways the gig economy is an archaic response to today's kind of economic climate, if you like.
It's been allowed to grow in a time when there's been very, very poor enforcement of established employment law. So we've seen in cases against Uber and a courier firm called City Sprint, and there's about to be a case that's going to the Supreme Court with Pimlico Plumbers, which is a plumber company in London. These lawsuits, the companies are losing time and time again. They're losing their appeals. They're being forced up and up and up to the highest courts in the land. And by the end of this month, we should have the beginnings of a ruling on Pimlico Plumbers, which could set a real precedent. But what the companies are arguing is that the people that work for them are self-employed, that self-employment allows them to enjoy certain freedoms, and that is an advantage to them. What most of the lawsuits are arguing is that the restrictions placed on these workers, on the likes of Don Lane and on the likes of James Farrar and Yassim Aslam, who's one of the leading claimants in the test case against Uber, is that, well, they can't be self-employed because they have to work certain patterns. They have to work according to what an algorithm tells them to do, that if they stop working, they get fined. And all sorts of conditions. So to give you an idea, drivers delivering for one courier that works on behalf of Amazon are required to handle up to 200 parcels a day and earn less than minimum wage over the amount of time it takes them to do that. That's because traffic might be bad, people might not be interstate delivery, so they have to revisit again and again, which is why often if you have an Amazon Prime subscription and you order next day delivery, the courier that arrives will basically throw the parcel at you as they run past your house, jump back in their van and screech down the road. One of the lawyers who's pursuing claims against that courier company described the conditions as almost Dickensian. And this is really getting to the nut of the issue. It's Uber has an app, and Uber used to claim to be a technology platform. It's since had to admit that it is a transport company, but it still says that its drivers are self-employed, which means that they don't get any rights, which means that when they feel a bit ill, they can't take a sick day because they won't get paid. In the case of some of the couriers that work for Amazon, if they take a sick day, they get fined, and they then have to work in order to get their balance, if you like, back up to zero. So that £150 fine would mean you were then in negative, and you wouldn't get paid again until you got it back to zero.
I'm always intrigued when companies say, well, we give great benefits. There's great benefits for our these people that are working for us, the freedoms they have. I mean, really, what are they kind of like thinking of? As far as I can see, the benefit is that it's a job that you can get at short notice in a...
The benefits potentially could be for people in very specific situations. So not somebody who is doing this full time as a delivery driver for a certain company. It's more maybe a student who wants to work two nights a week when they're not studying.
This is part of the problem with the name of the gig economy, right? It makes you think of someone young just doing it in between jobs. And in the case of Deliveroo, which is also going through the UK courts, there are two kinds of Deliveroo couriers. Not many people realize this. So the people that you see on bikes delivering your pizza to you late at night, some of them work set shifts and have to be available during those times. They have to go to meetup points. There are managers who are also delivery couriers who get paid a little more to keep an eye on them on behalf of the senior management at Deliveroo. And then...
Sounds
like a job, which is what they're arguing. Or they're arguing that they're employed, I think. They're arguing for full employment. Probably workers, actually. Anyway, and then there are couriers that can just open up the app, see if there's any work available, and take it as and when. That's not really the case with Uber, because they're not out for the couriers that work on behalf of Amazon and other companies like Marks and Spencer's and John Lewis, because they need the people to be available. In order for you to get a lift in London with a couple of minutes' notice, wherever you are, at any time of day, they have to have people who are working on the platform. So Uber imposes restrictions on how many rides you can decline, on when you have the app open, in order to get they need a certain amount of inventory on the platform in order to serve it. And definitely in the case of courier companies, well,
if you've got 200 parcels,
someone's got to deliver them.
Yeah.
So this is the problem with the freedom argument. It doesn't really play out when you start to interrogate it. And this is what employment tribunals have found, and this is what the Supreme Court in the United Kingdom may well find in the case of Pimlico Plumbers. So it was a very interesting week to see the way that the debate around the gig economy was progressing. The government's response to it has been absolutely slaughtered by unions and by workers' rights activists, whereas the government and some of the news reports have painted it as, you know, a major step forward. The major step forward would be to just enforce the law that you already have and have been failing to do so for more than a decade. That the law is there, and it's this irony that this perceived technological disruption could well be squashed by something as old and fusty as the Supreme Court.
It's just amazing, isn't it? Because to me, it seems like it's not that... The thing you've created isn't that innovative if it relies on fundamentally exploitative practices and is also underwritten by vast amounts of venture capital funding. What's innovative about you giving me a bunch of money and me saying, well, if I pay someone a pittance, I can get loads of consumers to use that service for cheap? You know, it doesn't seem that clever to me.
No, and it seemingly doesn't seem that clever to the courts either. So it was disappointing to see the way that the government had chosen to respond to this opportunity to be a lot more hardline on these kinds of issues, especially in a week when someone who worked in this form of employment lost their life, seemingly because of stresses that they had around the conditions that they were required to work under. So I encourage you to go and read The Guardian's reporting around the DBD courier, Don Lane. And if you want a bit more context around this, then I've written some analysis around the government's response to the Taylor Review and how it fits into this wider picture on wired.co.uk. You'll find it right on the homepage. Okay, story number four. We've been going on a bit, haven't we? Goodness me. Story number four, Fatbergs. Matt Reynolds.
Yeah, so I don't know, do you guys remember in September in London there was a 130-ton, I think like 250-metre long Fatberg beneath the streets of East London?
How could I forget?
I've marked it in my calendar.
Exactly. The Fatberg anniversary, Bergiversary.
Yeah. Define a Fatberg.
So a Fatberg is a kind of a huge mass of cooking oil, kind of congealed cooking oil, a lot of palm oil, that is kind of stitched together by wet wipes,
nice.
Condoms, sanitary towels, a few kind of like hypodermic needles, all this kind of like good stuff that tends to get flushed down toilets or dropped into drains, and it ends up causing these huge blockages in our sewers, especially in big cities like London.
It's like, so, it's the, basically the big version of like a blocked sink pipe.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is why you shouldn't pour fat down your drain, because eventually it turns into a Fatberg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I went to see the last remnants of that Whitechapel Fatberg, because it is the at the heart of a new exhibition that's opening this Friday, the 9th of February, at the Museum of London. The exhibition is called Fatberg, with an exclamation mark. And I went to talk to the curator of that exhibition to find out, you know, how do you take this bit of raw sewage and turn it into a museum piece?
This is incredibly toxic, disease-ridden, as it turned out, fly-infested, squelchy. It's very, very dangerous. You shouldn't be going anywhere near it.
Yeah,
you really do get all the glamorous jobs here.
I know, I do.
Yeah,
I
was like, yeah. Matt, can you go to East London to look at a slab of raw sewage, please?
Yeah, God, I would love to.
So they've dehydrated it.
Yeah, essentially. So what they did is that as soon as the Fatberg was announced, because we've had a few Fatbergs in the past, a curator from the Museum of London went to Thames Water and said, look, we'd love a slice of it. So while you're hosing away at it and while you're shoveling it out, they use kind of like pickaxes and shovels to basically heft it out through manhole covers.
Lovely.
Yeah, they said, can you hoover us up a slice of the Fatberg? So they did that. They used a kind of suction thing to break off a shoebox sized chunk. And then Thames Water put it in a kind of special facility, which is kind of like a lot of boxes really, and they air dried it for around 7 weeks. So it's mid-November that they took it out, and basically it now looks like a kind of crumbling breeze block, I would say, that it's kind of beautiful. I don't know. It has a kind of like a double-decker chocolate wrapper in the top. There are
nice.
Kind of flies kind of crawling out of it, and there's mold growing on some bits of it as well.
So it's alive.
Yeah, it's alive.
And
I was going to say, and although, like you said, James, when the Fatberg is wet and kind of like sludgy, it's got loads and loads of kind of diseases, especially a kind of sewage disease called Viles disease, which is fatal. It's kind of like carried in rat feces and stuff. That bacterial load is still present, but much, much lower. Now they've kind of got it in this kind of dehydrated form. So
yeah.
It's not so dangerous, and it's not going to spill on anyone.
And they also considered freezing it.
Yeah, exactly. So they kind of experimented with a couple of different options, because obviously the problem with this is highly toxic. It can't really be touched by anyone, and certainly can't be exposed to the air. So their first thought was, well, maybe we can kind of like freeze it, so it, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it stays solid, which is the same as some kind of like art exhibitions that involve blood have been frozen. Really, they thought they had 7 weeks to turn around this project, and they thought, actually, we don't really have the kind of capability to have an always on freezer, so we can't really have that. I think that would have been cool, seeing it frozen. Then they explored the idea of, well, can we kind of like pickle it in formaldehyde? Like, I know you remember that, those famous Damien Hirst sharks and cows
sheep
and stuff. Yeah, exactly. So they thought, maybe we can do that, because the benefit of that is it would kind of stay in a bit of a liquidy form, because at the minute it looks like a breeze block, whereas obviously the beauty of the Fatberg is that it's sludgy and almost like a kind of like a soap, I guess, like a kind of like a loose soap. So they thought about kind of like pickling it in formaldehyde, but basically they're a bit concerned that really that means that it kind of stays liquid, and so handling it becomes very, very difficult. So that's the problem when you've got, you know, you're dealing with raw sewage.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you know this, but I'm interested to know, when they are like, when they're not preserving Fatberg for a museum, what do they do with the rest of the Fatberg that they take out of the...
Yeah, so what they did with this Fatberg, and this isn't the case with all Fatbergs, most of the Fatbergs actually just kind of get kind of like disposed You know, they're kind of like the oil mass is taken away, and that's disposed of as landfill, like as you should dispose kind of like solid fat. And then the other stuff is, well, it's chucked into landfill as well, because it's just, you know, it's all these horrible sludgy nappies and stuff like that. With this Fatberg, what they did is they actually processed it in a kind of special plant and used that for kind of bio-oil. So the number 24 bus in London, which I think goes from like Hampstead Heath to maybe to Pimlico or Archway or something.
Fantastic route.
Yeah, I know. Great route, right? That is running on Fatberg fuel. So yeah,
Are they making a big song and dance about this?
No, I think that essentially...
The Fatberg fuel bus.
Yeah, I think, and to be honest, I'm not sure how much, like, maybe it's burnt through the Fatberg fuel already now.
What do you say, 250 meters of fat?
Yes, but it's hard though, isn't it, because there's this amazing web of wet wipes that
the amazing
like,
web of wet
yeah,
wipes.
Yeah, they're kind of like knitting it together, so I'm not entirely sure. I suspect that they thought, well, this Fatberg is getting a lot of attention, maybe we should do something good because people will talk about that.
Yeah.
Which obviously is a really, really good thing, but it's not like if you're when you're pouring your fat down the drain, well, it'll only get turned into biodiesel anyway. So
I am helping the environment.
Exactly. As a rule, you're not helping the environment, and it doesn't get turned into biodiesel because it's really difficult to process it all.
So back to the dehydrated shoebox-sized chunk of slime. Why on earth is it going in a museum? What's the point?
Yeah, so I kind of like put this to the curator, a woman called Vicky Sparks, and she said basically, the reason it is because it's a kind of it's a great example of city living now, and the Museum of London, the museum that it's in, is all about kind of you know, charting kind of like London history and having artifacts that really reflect how we live our lives. And I think that, you know, when I was talking to Vicky, she was saying that, you know, it's not the curator's job to really kind of like put a narrative. So the exhibition is not like preachy. It's not saying like, don't throw your fat away, although obviously don't, like down the sink. It's not about saying like, this is so bad. It's more about saying like, you know, look at this kind of like culture where we kind of like throw stuff away and we kind of like forget about it, and you flush down stuff down the toilet and you think like, wow, I'm glad that's sorted out by someone else. So, you know, that's if you even think about that. Like, I'm sure that thought doesn't cross, you know, my mind very often. And I think that the reason why it made sense to kind of bring this into a museum is actually to say, well, the way that we live our lives, especially when we're kind of like, you know, in these kind of like mass urban environments, has a really real impact environmentally and to other people. And this is a really interesting example of that.
And truly, nothing better sums up London in 2018 than a massive, deadly, fly-infested heap of detritus and fat.
Lovely.
It's on at the Museum of London right now. The exhibition is called Fatberg with an exclamation mark. It's open from the 9th, which is Friday, which is today if you're listening to this on the day that we put it out.
Yeah, exactly. And it's free to go to. And also the Museum of London's actually like really good, so the rest of it's decent. So if you're in the area,
there you go. It's decent, says Matt Reynolds. Yeah. If you haven't seen a Fatberg before, which you probably haven't, go and have a look and feel thoroughly grossed out. Maybe go after a long while after lunch or breakfast. Don't kind of go for a cup of tea and a slice of cake and a gaze at the Fatberg. It will probably make you feel a bit queasy. We'll leave it there. We've run on a little bit longer than we normally would, but we hope you've enjoyed our variety of stories this week. We'll be back again with another eclectic mix same time next week. We look forward to seeing you then. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.